How many times have our patients returned to our office and are just stuck in the cycle of chronic inflammation? We throw everything we have at them, nothing changes, and even our dentists are frustrated. Rather than throwing our hands up and shrugging, we need to be turning to PerioTrace by PerioProtect. I have seen the evidence firsthand and have helped so many hygienists find this resource because it really works, which is why there are so many products on the market now trying to imitate them. The results are speaking for themselves, but rather than going with an unproven product, stick with the only periodontal medicine delivery system cleared by the FDA. And not only that, but their support team is seriously among the best I've ever encountered, from the education to implementation to support when there's the inevitable bumps on the road. They are there for you. If you want to get in contact with them to learn more about how you can treat your patients better, head over to perioprotect.com/RDH. And on that site, at the bottom is a contact form that you can fill out or simply email them directly to ask for help. This is one thing I truly believe should be in every dental practice. perioprotect.com/RDH to stop the cycle of chronic inflammation.
You know, there are currently laws being passed to disparage their entire lives and existence. And sometimes, you know, the one thing that was precious to you, which was conscious and sensitive care, and that could be for any sort of minority group, is just gone. And we're trying to start from zero. It's just incredibly terrifying. At least if we can learn about it, we can try to deliver better care, more conscious care, more direct and tailored care for that person in our chair, that human, you know, not just that set of teeth that many of us would like to think is all we have to worry about, is just the teeth, and that's just not reality.
So what is it innately as a dental hygienist or a dental professional that changes when you get into private practice and you're no longer able to implement those same things you learned in school? But I don't think that's political. I think that's something that's internal that changes when you change, when you graduate or matriculate your respected educational setting.
Get ready for your unofficial dental hygiene podcast. These are the tales of two hygienists, one East Coast RDH and one West Coast Guygenist. Listen as they tackle the profession of dental hygiene with humor and enthusiasm. Now, please join Michelle Strange and Andrew Johnston as they tell you a tale of two hygienists.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of A Tale of Two Hygienists, episode number 275. My name is Andrew.
And this is Michelle, who was just told to be quiet.
Hold on. I'm pretty sure you told me to shut up. Daniel, if you can do me a favor, Daniel's our editor, everyone. If you can just take whatever I said and then just put it in like right here. I'm going to start talking in a minute. You're going to be quiet, right?
Shut up.
And now we're back. See, so she is the one that totally told me to shut up because she keeps interrupting me every time I try and do the intro.
Welcome. This is me being back, Andrew. This is what you wanted. And here I am.
Okay. I'm glad you're back. Is this week two in a row of you being back?
Yeah.
I'm just so excited. This is so good.
Is it though?
I mean, we had some special guests when you were gone and we got along really, really well. So I'm not saying you're being replaced, but like we could replace you.
Well, that's fine. I threatened you with it for years. Years and years threatened you with it. But hey, y'all, welcome to our dental podcast here.
Welcome, welcome, everyone.
We are really excited for yet another great episode. What do we got this week, Andrew?
Well, so we decided that this week we would focus on minority health. And the reason for that is April is National Minority Health Month. I think one of the things I do want to just say real quick on this part, there are a lot of different types of minorities. Specifically, there could be with age, gender, like there's all sorts of different things that we could get into. But that's not the purpose of this month. I'm going to read a passage from the National Minority Health Month website. So it says that this month is a time to raise awareness about health disparities that continue to affect racial and ethnic minority populations and encourage action through health education, early detection, and control of disease complications. So I don't want to say that this is going to be comprehensive in any way to all of the people that are underrepresented, but specifically we're going to be focusing on kind of the racial and ethnic minority populations. And we have some amazing guests to help us with this.
For sure. Well, one that has been on quite a few times, Daniel, is coming on, who's finally listening to the podcast. And Alicia, for the first time, I think we had her coming on one time. I can't remember what it was, and it just didn't work out. So I'm glad that we finally were able to get them on. And I love talking about this topic ever since, you know, I definitely got into public health a few years ago. And now I'm trying to get this mobile van up and going. And it is so dang hard to find a dentist.
Yeah. Mm. That, I mean, that's always a challenge, right?
Yeah. And that's, I mean, we talk about this a little bit on the podcast too, but it makes me so frustrated that I, as a hygienist with years and bazillion years of like extra education and years of experience and willing to go get additional education to go out into these places, and my state practice act and here old good old South of Kakalaki, we are not allowed to do very much, which is really annoying.
Can you translate that for those people that have no idea what Kakalaki?
The down south, South Carolina. They are kind of getting a little bit better, but I mean, even just looking at teledentistry, they're trying to like stifle that a little bit. It's just so frustrating. And I want to get out and I want to help these areas, these populations that don't have access to good care. And, you know, I joke on the podcast, but my favorite meme is like, teeth are not luxury bones for the wealthy. Like, we all deserve to have healthy, strong dentition, free of disease. Oh, what a dream that would be, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think if anyone knows, like has any connections to like the presidency, and they can do an executive order to overwrite all of the state legislative practice acts, just so that we can do the right thing for people, that would be great. Just let me know, Andrew@atailor2hygienist.com, and me and the president will talk about that.
Yeah. Biden, we're talking to you, sir. If you could just email us.
Hey, you're not allowed to talk to him. I'm trying to invite him on this podcast.
Can we start with Fauci? Even though I've talked about
it. Didn't we try and get him a long time ago too? And then he got like too popular, and he was doing
he got way too popular with all the
really popular celebrities and stuff.
We're a little ballsy with this pod. At least I am. I invited Brene Brown to come on.
Surprisingly, she rejected us. Actually, did you get any response that even?
I did actually. They did email me back and were like, and this is, well, the only reason I did that because she went on this obscure tiny little podcast to promote a book. And I, granted, I was listening to it like, I don't know, a year after it was published. And I was like, well, if she will go on that one, we have tens and tens of thousands of people who listen. Like, let's come on over, Brene. But then her book launched and she was just too busy for us little folk.
I mean, if she's not doing anything now, let's try and get her on again. I'm sure she's got nothing going on.
She's got two podcasts now.
virtual speaking engagements and all that. Yeah, it's no big deal.
It's fine. Yeah. You're not that busy, Brene. When we need a lot of help here in dentistry.
That's right.
So you'd be busy over here. So I'm really excited to have this podcast with Daniel and Alicia. We do mention in it that this is kind of a heavy topic. It's a big topic. It's a topic we need to talk about a little bit more. We do discuss ways that you can do it well. I will tell you that I have screwed this up and messed it up, and we're all going to say the wrong things. Just be open to the challenge and be open to change and learning. And I hope that you guys enjoy this episode, though, with Daniel Lopez and Alicia Maria.
Before we get to the interview, we want to say a big thank you to Paradise Dental Technologies, or PDT, for supporting the continuing education portion of this podcast for so many years. If you do not know already, many of our full-length episodes count for CE. You'll find the links in the show notes, or you can sign up for our newsletter by going to atailor2hygienist.com. When you sign up for the newsletter, we will periodically send out links to shows that have expiring CE courses attached. And none of this could be possible without the support of the amazing people over at PDT. So check out their hygiene and other instruments at pdtdental.com. That's pdtdental.com. Now, on to the interview. Welcome, everyone, to the interview portion of this podcast. April is Minority Health Month, as many of you know. And so we decided that it would be a really good opportunity to bring some people on. And it's funny, we talked about this in the
the pre-discussion, the pre-show.
Pre-show.
That's an industry term, right? I should have known that. In the pre-show, how everyone should be talking about this, but there's so many people that don't actually know about it. And we want to talk about the fundamentals of minority healthcare and what that looks like in dentistry. And so we brought on some amazing guests. We brought back Daniel Lopez, who all of you guys have heard before. Daniel, we get lots of listener comments about how you should be on more and more. Did you know that?
For what reasons? Because that could be good or bad.
I think they want more
for good reasons.
Yeah.
And also, side note, Daniel's listening to the podcast these days.
Oh my god!
Yeah, like one episode a week. Like, you know, if I'm feeling a little spicy, you know trying to support my loved ones here.
Thanks, Daniel. But so, Daniel, for those of you who are maybe new to the podcast, do you mind just reintroducing yourself to them if they haven't heard you before?
So Daniel Lopez, I'm born and raised in New York City, and I got into dental hygiene in 2012. It's my second career after being a pastry chef for 10 years. Immediately upon graduating, I started working in public health in a federally qualified health center, and it's afforded me really great opportunities to just kind of dive into the most underserved and the most in need populations, to work on people who come from where I come from and beyond, but all kind of wind up in the same area to have focused and sensitive care, you know, conscious of their needs, their backgrounds and everything. With that, you know, I've met a lot of different people and done a lot of different things related to dentistry in and out of the op. So, you know, I've kind of taken all of that experience to try and give my best back to my roots and where I've come from.
I think, you know, in the conversations that we've had, Daniel, like, you've always been able to explain it in a way that I can understand. And I think that that goes a long way towards how you're delivering it to your patients as well. I think your background as a pastry chef, I think, actually has a lot of bearing here on your experiences with dentistry. Then Daniel, you brought a friend on today, and we know Alicia from the dental world. Alicia, if you don't mind introducing yourself for our listeners.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much, Andrew and Michelle, for having me on A Tale of Two Hygienists today. And thank you so much, Daniel, for inviting me to be your co-podcast, I guess, co-host. I am a clinician, dental hygienist. I'm originally from Detroit, Michigan. Similar to Daniel, I am not a pastry chef, but my family still calls me Sugar Bear. And if you know anything about sugar and cavities, you know that does not yield a dental hygienist. So I have a really strong background in public health dentistry and what it meant to grow up in the city of Detroit and how I felt experiencing some of those public health services. So I'm really happy to be on as a support. I also founded a nonprofit called Hygienists for Humanity. And our whole goal is to go around the country and help people get access to quality services and education and ultimately quality care.
I should have worn my Hygienists for Humanity shirt. It's one of my faves.
I'll see it.
Well, welcome back, Daniel, and welcome, Alicia. We're really excited to have you both on and talking about a really important topic.
I think, you know, if you guys don't mind, if we talked about this again in the pre-show, but I want to talk about politics and the idea of minority health. And, you know, I know originally in the pre-show I said, hey, I don't want to make this a political discussion. I want to make this a discussion about taking care of the individual, taking care of people and populations. But we started talking about how that may or may not actually be able to happen. And maybe we should start off with Michelle's viewpoints of whether or not something like this should be political or not political.
Well, everything on this podcast and my thoughts on it are always like these knee-jerk reactions, and then I try to like talk through them in real time, and people get to see the inside of my messy brain sometimes. But when you said, like, let's not make this political, like, let's, which came from a very like important, like, that's a conversation that we need to have. I wish we could strip the politics from this and talk about human beings that need to have the care that they deserve, these human rights. And one of my favorite memes is when we've called teeth luxury bones, and like they're not just luxury bones for the rich. Like, we want to make sure that everybody has access to care. However, my knee-jerk reaction and my response to that was like, you can't. They can't be separated. They should be separated, but they can't be separated because there are so many things that are politicized, and there are so many barriers to care that are ingrained in political movements. So that was my first reaction. And Alicia actually had a reaction to that, that she disagreed. And then, so I'm like, I'm excited to talk about it.
Yeah, I would agree to disagree that this is a topic that is political. Yes, we do understand that there are some areas that are underserved, but I do feel that when you enter into a profession that is patient-facing, you don't go into this profession with a political mindset. You go into this profession with a heart, and a heart for healthcare and humanity and helping people. So while we do understand that there are some political barriers that are in the way of patients getting access to care and potentially even individuals getting access to higher education, I do think that the larger conversation is what happens when we get these individuals into a profession that is centered around caring for the underserved or caring for communities that may have been looked over. So I think more than anything else, innately, this conversation to me is about why do dental hygienists not practice the way that they were designed to practice? When we graduated from hygiene school, we left hygiene school with the notion of take temperature on every patient, take blood pressure on every patient, do an annual perio chart, update radiographs. And this was regardless to whether or not they had health insurance or not. So what is it innately as a dental hygienist or a dental professional that changes when you get into private practice and you're no longer able to implement those same things you learned in school? But I don't think that's political. I think that's something that's internal that changes when you change, when you graduate or matriculate your respective educational setting.
And I definitely, like, I hear it. I'm going to probably sit with that because my initial reaction is like, I don't think it is something that changes in them as practitioner. I think they get into a profession that's health insurance driven, and that health insurance is unfortunately a political issue. And sometimes I feel like I had community health. Did y'all have community health? Like, that's a part of the curriculum, right? Yeah. And so I learned those things, but it was, I don't think we applied it, and we didn't talk about it from like, this is what private practice is going to look like when you leave here. And this is the should, without regard for health insurance, human needs, whatever. Like, this is what your standard should be. And unfortunately, there are going to be some offices where your standard just goes straight to hell. It becomes like the crust of the earth. That bar is low, low, low. And like, here's how you are going to not fight against it, but maneuver within it so that you can still care for people, even if they are in a practice like that.
Yeah.
I don't know. Again, here's my messy brain trying to figure this out.
I do think at our roots, when, you know, we're ready to graduate and go into the world, we're leaving from what can be considered an idyllic situation. You know, the patient comes in and we treat the patient. Money is barely an issue, especially if you're in a community college and whatnot. If not all of the larger universities are insurance driven as well. So in the smaller hygiene schools, typically the patient shows up, they get all the treatment they need. It's a pittance. Like, it's an out-of-pocket, forgettable kind of fee. Like, I believe the pro fees in my clinic were 15 total for x-rays, exam, everything. That's affordable for pretty much anyone. And we would even waive that if, you know, someone was homeless or just, you know, so that's what we graduate thinking that we're going to maintain. And the reality is just something entirely different. And going back to the politics issue, I believe that's a different discussion. I believe politics is ingrained in everything we do because of the whole inception of our profession. You know, we're still the only profession that's controlled by another dentist, right? That's a political thing. You know, a lot of the things that created the disparities that we see between minorities and the majority population are results of segregation and political zoning and all kinds of things. That is just such a larger conversation. And we're not prepared for that as graduate hygienists, you know. That's not our field, that's not our thing, but it's still something that exists and needs to be addressed. And who's doing it? Is it the people actually delivering the care? Is it people working from universities and whatnot? And is something being done about it? And what can we do to kind of bridge that gap as practicing clinicians, especially if we're in public health and whatnot? It's so much bigger than any one of us. I think, you know, we have to do what we can. We have to try. I think what we can all try to learn more, to see why is this happening? Why has this happened? What are the historical contexts that have led to this situation? So we can kind of work best within our means. But you're kind of right. You know, we're going to have to kind of jump between two sides. Either you fully go into the politics and whatnot, which is something that kind of takes you out of the op, or you just you know, have this awareness, and then you do the best you can with what you can when you're actually in the operatory with that patient. So it's a fine line. And at least if we can learn about it, we can try to deliver better care, more conscious care, more direct and tailored care for that person in our chair, that human, you know, not just that set of teeth that many of us would like to think is all we have to worry about is just the teeth. And that's just not reality.
Yeah.
I could not agree more. I really feel like this is a continuum. And once you get a patient into public health, if you are not providing them with the same care that you would give to a person in private practice, it's going to be a revolving cycle of gum disease and tooth loss or decay. You have to provide that educational platform for the patient, or you're not really helping them. I think it's easier to teach someone to fish than it is give them a fish sandwich. And I think in public health, we're offering fish sandwiches every single day, and we're not teaching enough people to fish.
That's such an interesting thing that you just said, Alicia, that has triggered me through the years of volunteering in some organizations. And that was, there was a dentist who truly had a heart for public health. He was just the best to work for. And every time I volunteered, he'd come back in there and he was like, you just give these patients that private practice treatment. And I was like, as opposed to what? Like, as opposed to what? And I get he wasn't saying like, I'm doing something so grand and wonderful. I think it was that there were some other people coming into that. Like, I don't even know how to word it, but it was a trigger for me. And I was like, but as opposed to what else is there to give these humans that are asking for your care and you have the knowledge? But that's a real interesting perspective.
It baffles me. You know, I attempt. So when I'm not doing grad school or nonprofit stuff or all of the things that I do, I'm temping and I'll go to different offices. And all I know how to do is be a dental hygienist. And I'll go in and I have the mindset of standard of care. I'm doing the bare minimum. And it's amazing to me how many patients will say, you've given me the best care ever. And I'm like, I didn't do anything extra. I did the bare minimum and I talked to you about what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have complicated feelings about the concept of private practice treatment versus public health treatment, because I feel that what some may consider ideal, the private practice treatment, isn't enough, or it just doesn't work, because most dentistry is delivered through the private practice cottage model, one office or one small group of offices, but they all kind of practice the same way. You know, your insurance covers two cleanings a year. We have to meet this, and this expectation for the thing. And then we just have these tens of millions of people who are falling through the cracks and they're not getting care at all, or they're getting substandard care, or their only option is a private practice that just can't meet the needs of the population. I felt like if private practice, if that model was so right, so ideal, why are we in this disparity? Why isn't it working? I believe it's failed. And I believe sometimes we have to look at ourselves and the way we've been trained and the way we actually think about delivering care and question, is it actually the right way? Like, should we be doing this way and that way? And what are we actually accomplishing? How is it impacting the population as a whole versus the individual? But then we also have to think about the individual at the same time. So like, it's like you're juggling a whole bunch of different balls. You're trying not to let any ball fall to the floor. But at the same time, you know, where are you actually going to wind up with these people? Like, you guys know how many patients I see. Like, some days in my burn practice, I see up to 20 patients a day. And it's crazy. It's a nightmare. A lot of those are kids, so they're not all adults. But I have to make it work. And one of the benefits that I have with my public health model is that, you know, if I feel like I didn't give them what they needed and I didn't serve them well, I bring them back at no cost to them. I bring them back the next day. I wait a week, see how they feel. And so inflammation can go down regardless of cost. Right. But we're kind of in that mindset that everything has to be done perfectly, that one visit, because that's all they've got for 6 months. Right. And so it's like, does that really work? Like, if you could just bring that person back without having to think about having them pay out of pocket or whatnot and bring them back and observe them over multiple visits, you know, what more can you do? How many more people can you actually bring back from the edge of, you know, disease if you could just treat regardless of the private practice and insurance kind of norms that we're so accustomed to working within?
And also private practice grows if they have disease.
Mm-hmm.
So like, why would you bring them back? Like, get it right in the first time? Because actually disease means the private practice model grows, right?
And that bothers me so much. Why on earth are we dental hygienists? Why on earth are we the only healthcare modality that's centered around prevention and no one pays attention to what we have to say? I really find it troubling to think that insurances are driven on restoration when everything that we're restoring is able to be prevented. So I think that going forward, and I've been following DentaQuest a lot, and they're moving more towards a format of preventistry, not dentistry, but how do you prevent dentistry?
My favorite new word.
I love that word. But what does it look like if your insurance is paying out more for preventative than they are for restoration? I think it's going to change the way that private practice looks, and I think it's going to trickle down into public health. But right now, we're more on a reactive spectrum, where it should be a proactive spectrum, when everything that we're doing or everything that's happening in dentistry in terms of the patient's disease is able to be prevented with hygiene, resources, and education.
One interesting thing in New York State is that, you know, one of the typical criticisms of a federally qualified health center and the Medicaid model is that it's encounter-based, right? So a lot of people point a finger and say, oh, you know, you only do one procedure, one restoration when somebody needs 12, and you bring them back one at a time so that you get the most encounters. That's a fair criticism, you know, because then it kind of keeps people in a cycle of disease. You can barely catch up on their treatment plans and close one out, you know, and bring them back to neutral. That a lot of places are very guilty of exploiting that encounter-based reimbursement system. New York State is currently in the middle of moving to a value-based system or an outcomes-based health model where there are set goals and you're reimbursed more for achieving a state of health and reducing like recurrent caries and recurrent periodontal disease in a patient. And they're trying to just change the shape of how healthcare is delivered in the state. It's a huge undertaking, and that can keeps getting kicked down the road because it's just such a paradigm shift, right? But it sounds like on multiple fronts, you know, maybe we're moving towards a model that's going to have better population outcomes. If, you know, we can focus on, did you actually do meaningful work? Did you actually cure or heal this patient?
But I think though, Daniel, the problem that we're going to run into though is that and going back to the whole minority thing, right? There's pockets of populations that are going to respond to different treatment types differently. And so when you're trying to do outcomes based, you need a clinician that is going to be able to have all of the tools available to them, whether it's, you know, something like saliva testing.
And understand their community that they're working in.
Yeah. And understand the community and being able to communicate that to the community and have that received by the community in a way that is going to actually yield the results that they need. It's a big undertaking.
Huge.
Let's talk about that for a second and having the provider be the person communicating with the patient. One of the biggest barriers, if not the biggest, to quality focused care on minority groups is that typically the care provider is not from, does not look like, does not speak like, does not communicate with the people that they're treating. This is most addressed in public health, but there's still shortcomings. Often in public health, say a dentist is incentivized to work in a Medicaid office for loan repayment, which, you know, they'll apply for the NHSC, the National Health Service Corps grant, which gives $50,000 in loan repayment every 2 years that you register for it. And it's kind of like a wham, bam, I'm going to knock out these loans. I'll learn what I will learn and I'll deliver care and then I'm gone and I go to private practice. So we have people who are not from these neighborhoods, who are not like these people, treating the population, and even if they've built up a good rapport and good trust with them, they leave, right? And so there's this endless cycle of new providers. The most at risk and the most underserved are constantly being seen by people who are just learning the ropes. And on top of that, have to spend a year or more even learning how to talk to them or how to acknowledge them or to even consider where they're coming from. And largely, it's because there's such a racial disparity in dentistry. The dental population, the dentist population does not reflect the general population. There is a significant majority of white dental practitioners versus Black, Hispanic, Asian, and all other, you know, subset of minority there. And it's something that is slowly changing, but it's still endemic. It's still an issue. And there's such a long history of minority patients not being able to trust their providers, both medical and dental. And there are good reasons for that. There's a long history of exploitation, of experimentation, of dismissal of people's pain. The Black population especially seems or is the most dismissed when it comes to just, what's the word I'm looking for? Empathy. Dental providers and medical providers are less empathetic to the Black population than they are to white. It's a really sad and interesting statistic that because of this, because of the lack of empathy for the pain of Black people, the Black population was spared the opioid epidemic to the same magnitude that the white population was, because the white population was on a whim by their medical provider specifically prescribed opioids. And it hit them so much harder than any other racial group, because the other races were just not given pain medication. They were told to just deal with it, or whatever reason that, you know, their provider came up with. And there's a long history of that. There's a long history of not believing pain, not caring about pain, not caring to deliver the right care. And who is it coming from? Is this mindset coming from people who are from this neighborhood or from this population serving these people? Typically not. Typically somebody else, somebody very detached. And so how can you rebuild trust? How can you instill that confidence in the population that you're going to be treated well, that your providers are going to listen to you, especially when that provider doesn't look like you? Like, what's our answer to that? Because there seems to be a huge barrier to entry for both dentists and hygienists, especially where the racial gaps are even wider. That's a toughie.
it definitely needs to be said for sure.
And I think that this topic is very touchy because of the racial disparities that are present in our country. So there are some people that practice dentistry and they might use the terminology, "I don't see color." You have to be able to see color in dentistry because you have to understand that there are systemic ailments that might disproportionately affect one racial group or class than another. So if you don't see color, you're not going to address these concerns as it relates to oral health with your patient. As an example, I had a patient who had rampant caries and gum disease. And when he came to the practice, I had to literally sit with him knee to knee as a Black guy, sit with him knee to knee and let him know, look, you are literally putting yourself at higher risk for diabetes and heart attack and stroke and even kidney disease. And he's like, nobody's ever told me that. Well, because you're a Black person and I'm going to have to relate to you as a Black person, I think it has to be said. And he's like, I have to come back here and see you because there's no one else that would ever tell me this. So I don't know that other people are afraid to say, because you're Asian, you're at a higher risk for periodontal disease, or because you're Indian, you might have higher risk for this. Or I don't know that not seeing color is okay in dentistry. So you have to be able to address those racial disparities and understand the shortcomings that each of these racial groups might be faced with.
So, I mean, you have to be educated about them though, right? I mean, I think we're never going to get away from, or maybe in the very, very future, we're never going to get away from the majority white dentist going into these areas to get their student loans repaid and things like that. And they're going to have these tough conversations in a way that's meaningful. So I guess my question, or hopefully that you guys can talk to a little bit more, is how does that conversation evolve, and how does that person, one, get comfortable in learning about the cultural differences that they're going to be seeing, and how do they quickly in one or two meetings connect with somebody that is, from their perception, going to be completely different than someone of similar racial background?
That's a hard one, because I don't think that can be fully learned and executed only by interacting with the patient that one or two times. It requires a personal investment. You have to challenge yourself. You have to put yourself in a zone of discomfort. You have to unlearn a lot of the things that you were taught and a lot of the assumptions and the biases that you were raised with that you aren't even aware that you might have. You know, it requires putting yourself in a position of vulnerability. What am I not seeing? What can I learn? You actually have to be willing to learn outside the operatory, to read, to watch history, to, you know, learn about history and see exactly what is behind not just this person, but the population, and maybe why this person believes this or acts this way or does this, or maybe does not have this awareness. It's so much more than they just don't know, right? It's so much more than, oh, they're just uneducated, or there's, you know, there's just a whole system of cogs turning that keeps people where they are. And if you don't learn that, if you don't see the reasons why there are such disparities, I don't believe you're ever going to get into a position where you can effectively deliver that care or reach that patient. And it's a big undertaking. It's a lot to ask somebody, especially when a lot of us just want to do the work. And a lot of us just want to debride the teeth or fill that tooth or make that bridge. And if that's all you're here for, and you know, you can certainly deliver great care and whatnot, but if you're trying to be that person that's getting through, that's trying to make an impact, it's going to take so much. And I don't know if there's a really good answer for that. Like, how do you do this? You know, or where do I go? Because it's just, there's so many avenues that you need to go down to actually get to a point where you're really making a dent in this problem. And I wish I had a better answer for that, but I
just... Is there any benefit of, okay, Andrew White dentist goes into a population that's not primarily white, and then I surround myself with team members, the staff that is not. Does that further push me as an outlier, or does that help the community embrace the care that's going to be delivered?
That's a tough one, but if I'm going to put myself in the shoes of a patient, let's say my neighborhood, which is primarily Puerto Rican, Dominican, and Black. If I go into an office and I see that the entire support staff is mostly made up of people that are from the neighborhood or, you know, in the population, in the know, and then I see the one non-minority, the one white dentist, or in any, you know, any combination thereof, I'm like, oh, so this is how it is. You know, you're the outsider, you know,
it's a problem.
And there are reasons for that. There are reasons for that, you know, because it's obvious sometimes. It's obvious that, you know, what's trying to be done, and it may be being done with good intentions. The intentions are there, but the way it looks is something else entirely, and it can be off-putting, and it's a mixed bag. It really is a mixed bag. Some people are going to react in a certain way, like, oh, wow, this is, you know, this is somebody not from here. Like, and they're going to be guarded, you know, and they may not communicate with you, or they may not tell you everything, because they'll be like, what's the point? You know, I do believe it takes more of a personal effort, like, you know, learning the language and, or the lingo, whatever that is, either learning another language entirely or learning how people speak, so that you don't actually have to turn to your assistant and be like, what did you just say? Like, you know, cause that sticks. You know, you gotta get your feet wet if you're going to be the one in that office that's different, you know, and it may not matter. You know, maybe you're just always going to be that outsider, and there might not be anything you can do about it.
And it's kind of our turn, the white folk.
I guess here's the thing, is like, and that's completely fine. Like, I wouldn't mind, you know, I think I have a different personality type, but I wouldn't mind myself going to any community and being understood of, like, oh, it's not the best optics that white guy's in there doing this. I understand that, but that necessarily wouldn't bother me. Does it still need to happen so that they can at least have care, or are they occupying a slot, a position that could be filled by someone else? Should we wait for another month to be able to get a doctor from the community to service that population? There's a shortage of doctors of the minority communities too, which is also the part of the problem.
And there's still that debt, you know, and there really isn't that much incentive to go for the scholarships and get your years in FQHCs and sometimes stay there for like the good benefits, as there is into just going into private practice and, you know, getting a lot more money than even the loans would see you combined with your salary. You know, it's, you know, some people are just going to be like, I need to get these things and I need to get these loans paid off. And I want to have a certain lifestyle, and you're probably not going to have that lifestyle working in public health. So, you know, is it fair to expect that minority dentists and whatnot should just go there because they're expected to and put that weight on their shoulders? That's something else. That's a whole nother conversation. Like, should they be burdened with that? You know, with, you know, having to be the ones relegated to working here and sticking there when they could have another lifestyle, you know, it's a very personal choice. And I can't blame someone for not wanting to take that up. You know, some people want to live their best lives, you know, and for some that's going back into their roots, to their community. And for some that's getting the most they can and taking care of themselves and their families. And, you know, and I, you know, we can't judge them for that. Or at least I can't. Maybe I'm missing something here, but.
No, and I think that brings up a really because I know I said I wasn't going to talk too much about the political side of this, but I think that that's where I have a really hard time separating it, because if hygienists have the ability to go and do more in these communities and we could stand on that prevention leg that we tout as professionals for decades upon decades, maybe we could serve some communities a little bit better than needing to have that dentist come in and do extractions and do, you know, fillings and things like that. And that is very political, that hygienists cannot go into these areas because we are not, you know, things that we all know about in our industry.
But let me ask about that question though, Michelle. So are in these communities, the hygienist looked the same as a dentist, like a middle to high level provider? No, Alicia's shaking her head no. So it would be like, that could be then a viable solution is what you're saying.
I think that's a viable solution. Taking a dental hygienist that looks like his or her community and putting them into an area where there's seemingly a dental desert, you know, and educating them on what quality is, regardless of the color. She could be, or he could be Black, white, Asian, Hispanic. It could be any demographic. But when you go out into the field and say, hey, my name's Alicia, I'm going to be your hygienist, and I'm here to focus on what you need, and I have a colleague, I can make sure that they're going to see you. They're in the city. It's Dr. Johnston, Dr. Andrew Johnston. He looks nothing like me. They are set up with the mindset that I met Alicia and she's setting me up to have quality care. So when they get to Dr. Johnston, they're not thinking, oh, he's a white dentist and he doesn't care about me. They already know that they have a relationship with their hygienist, and I've instilled some trust in them that I want the best for you. So I think it's time out for quality to look like a color. I think a lot of people think that if I have a white provider or a man dentist, or I have a man hygienist, or I'm going to get different care. No, we're all signed on to do the same quality care. Unfortunately, some of us finish the bottom of our class. So you do have those providers who are not, you know, as passionate about doing quality work. But for the majority, I would say it's time out to just say that just because you're a certain color or you're a certain gender, that you're not going to receive this quality. And I think across the board, if we band together and we practice the standard of care, it doesn't matter what color you are. If you're having motivational interviewing and you're actually educating your patient on prevention, you're going to develop this level of trust and respect from your patients. And when they get to that higher level provider, regardless of the color, they already understand that dental hygiene is about protecting you from, I guess, preventable dentistry.
I love all of that. That I think that is the key, right? I think that having the introductions, I think that focusing on the real problems and fixing the problems, but I still have one lingering logistical issue that I still can't get myself over is in the studies that you guys sent over before. I was looking through one of them and it said something like, there's a couple of states down south that had a very large Black population. And there was not proportionally the number of dental hygienists or dentists to be able to provide solely for that Black population. So if we were to switch it, Alicia, if we were to say, okay, now Andrew is going to go out as a dental hygienist to this Black community and try and deliver dental hygiene prevention care. But by the way, when you do need restorative care, when you do need therapeutic care, I have this colleague of mine that is a Black dentist or a Black specialist or whatever. Does that model work very well, or does it not really work as well? Is that a possibility?
I think that is a great possibility because, again, if you're in an area where there's a dental desert and there's no provider that's going to go out to service these patients, when we have Andrew going out, we're actually helping these people get access to care. But again, just to reiterate, I think that that does help because you're going into their respective community. They're not going to you. So you're meeting them where they are. You're not saying, oh, you don't have insurance. Oh, you don't have a car. Oh, you don't have a toothbrush. You're going to where they are and you're meeting them where they are. And again, you're developing this relationship and this level of trust. So when Andrew says, hey, I have this amazing colleague who looks just like you, they're like, really? Andrew, you're already the best. I want to see a colleague that looks like you. But if you're telling them, hey, look, I have this amazing colleague, you're going to love them. They're going to go see him because they've already developed this level of trust for you as a professional. It's not because you're white and it's not because you're a man. It's because you went to where they are. You met them where they are. And I think that's where most patients really get the best care, is when they feel like someone hears them, when they feel like they're heard, or someone really understands what they're going through.
And I think that also is something that Daniel and I have done in other countries, where it's not necessarily, like, I wouldn't suspect that if you, white man, Andrew, is going into a community, that you would be doing that on your own, right? Like, you would probably partner and make relationships with people who already have relationships in that community. So you're coming in through this kind of like trusted path, this like the gate has already been open, versus you coming in as like the white savior, which is where I think things like that fail. And I mean, as they should, like, you shouldn't be coming in there as a white savior. So, I don't know. That's what I'm thinking when I hear like a study like that, or like, you know, it's you're coming in on like the shoulders of people who are already trusted in a community that could help elevate you and your trust in that community. Would I be wrong? Do y'all think I'm wrong in thinking that?
I don't think that you're wrong in that, Michelle, but I think to take it a step further would be, not only would Andrew go into this, sorry to pick on you, Andrew, but not only would Andrew go into this community and service these clients, he would also be educating them on this is a viable career option for you.
Oh.
You can also be a dental hygienist. You can also be a dentist. You can be an oral surgeon. So you're actually opening up the eyes and the mindset of someone who has never experienced a dental professional, seemingly a dental professional that looks like them. But if you hear someone who is the quote unquote white savior say, hey, look, you can get here too, you're now opening up a channel for this community to have someone come out of their community and actually go back and deliver those services. I'm from Detroit. I didn't have a person that looked like me in Detroit saying, hey, you can be a dental hygienist or a dentist. It was like just a big idea and a big notion. But what would have happened if I had someone come to my elementary, middle, or high school for career day and say, this is a viable career option? You should come back and service your community. So I think just to piggyback on the good work that someone like someone like Andrew would do in an underserved community, I think it would be better served if he would help them explore the options of, you know, having a career like this.
I love that. I've never had my name mentioned so much on the podcast ever.
Andrew.
So much. Like,
I think one thing that really matters for this is, do you stick with it? Because a lot of times people do come in with good intentions and they come to neighborhoods, but then you disappear after a year, then disappear after 2 years because it's a lot of work. It's emotionally draining.
That's the pipeline.
Yeah.
You need a pipeline. For someone to come in after Andrew, who is just as passionate, and it's going to have someone that comes in after that person who's just as passionate, but you have to have a pipeline in the system.
Or build the community to be able to support themselves.
But now it's going to be a dental desert again.
And often that pipeline, it breaks either from a lack of funding or just someplace closes down or, you know, and then the population is right back to zero. You know, I feel like consistency is so important. You know, building a relationship, having that familiarity and reliability. And that's often something that just doesn't happen because it's hard or it's expensive, or you know, people that you depended on, like, you know, maybe that dentist moved, or, you know, maybe that practice went out of business or something and it just disappears. And then that really damages people, the unreliability of, you know, the system in place. Because it's happened, like my previous job, Callen Lord, the dental clinic's still gone. That's my 10,000 patients that I've been treating for the past 8 years because of coronavirus. They weren't able to open up the dental clinic. It's been a year now. It's probably going to be at least another year if they ever open it back up again. And all those people that I built relationships with they're being sent, you know, good luck, basically. Too bad. And that's so, so damaging. And we never know what can happen, you know. Obviously, coronavirus was a bit of a big wrench to throw in the engine, but, you know, smaller things happen that still impact.
So just to pivot, I'm curious if there is we're talking about human beings in the chair, and like, what about those people who don't make it to our chair because of some really horrible behavior, because of a fear of what has happened in some medical, I guess, industries for a bazillion years. And I'm wondering if you feel like your patient population that you won't be seeing anymore that might not have access to care at Callen Lord, do you fear that they won't go to a dental office or a dental practice because they might not get the same care, or they might not have, they might be stigmatized in a way if they go, and so maybe they just don't get treatment?
I can guarantee you that they will not be seeking care for a long time, if ever. I've had no shortage, and it's mostly my trans patients of color who are the biggest intersection of the most underserved and neglected categories. My trans patients of color will probably never seek care again unless that clinic opens back up.
That hurts to hear.
Yeah, because I've literally had people say they would rather die than go somewhere else.
Is there no other allies in the community that could help them?
There are, but there's a fear of restarting everything. Because like we're talking people that I saw like pre-transition, mid-transition, and post-transition, and they've gone through that whole journey. And so like I was able to get the whole relationship with them. And that's really important to them. That's really, really important to them. And sometimes life just happens, you know, what if I just left anyway? You know, they have to start over with somebody else, but there's still that familiarity of the facility, the place, that location. You know, sometimes it's more than just you, you know, it's the comfort of a place, you know, and starting that over is just incredibly fear-inducing for people who are experiencing the kind of disparities where they're killed more than anybody else, where they're hated in the public eye. And, you know, there are currently laws being passed to disparage their entire lives and existence. And sometimes, you know, the one thing that was precious to you, which was conscious and sensitive care, and that could be for any sort of minority group, is just gone. And we're trying to start from zero is just incredibly terrifying. Did that answer the question? Because I kind of went off the tangent there.
Yeah. No, it's definitely, now my brain is kind of spinning out.
Can I piggyback on what Daniel said? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So I agree that these patients are 9 times out of 10 never going to return for routine preventative care because they don't have a person like Daniel that understands them. But Michelle, when this patient does come back, because they will come back, because we know what happens when you don't have preventative care, they're going to come back in pain. So when they come back in pain, how do we recover? How do we share with the patient, I apologize that you had a lapse in your treatment. I apologize that you experienced this unfair treatment and you didn't have the quality care that you deserve. But hi, my name is Michelle, and I'm here to make sure you get everything that you need. I'm a dental hygienist, and I understand that you have a tooth that needs to be extracted, but I want to make sure that we don't have any more teeth come out. My job as a prevention specialist is to educate you, give you the tools and the tips that you need so we can avoid this in the future. And I think that's where we recover, because these patients will come back. But how do we stop them from coming back with progressed or advanced disease? So I think it's just a matter of like what Daniel, I think it was Daniel who said that earlier, was just it's taking a personal inventory of what do I know about this demographic that I'm seemingly going to service? How can I connect with them when they do sit in my chair? And how can I be a person and help them to understand that I want to help them?
And do you think there is a way for our... How often should we get out into these communities? Because again, just thinking about like that human that's probably not going to make it to our chair until they are in pain. How can we, well, I'm sure this is very broad strokes here, but like what can we be doing in our communities?
Big changes happen in small shifts. And word to Michael Jackson, I'm starting with the man in the mirror and I'm asking him to change his ways. If you want to make the world a better place, you gotta
go on.
Make a change. I can sing. Want to do some karaoke? But no, seriously, you have to start with yourself, and it doesn't start in the dental op. It doesn't start in the operatory. It starts in your community. So if you're at a farmer's market, if you're at a grocery store, if you're at a park, if you're at church, wherever you are, assert yourself as a professional. If you see someone who's having a hard time, be a resource. Be a friend. Let them know that you're an ally in their community, and they may not have connections with any medical professional, but let them know, hey, I'm a dental medical professional and I'm here to help you. So I don't think that it's like, do we wait until they come to us? Do we have to go out with our scrubs on, with our scalers in our hands, proudly saying, who wants their teeth cleaned? No, you just be a good person innately. And how do you become a better person? You just make decisions every day that isn't a step in that direction. That's my soapbox.
And you brought up motivational interviewing earlier, which is something that we've been talking about a lot on the podcast. And I think is a very important key to in the conversation, or a piece of the puzzle in the conversation, because I would imagine, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but if I am coming at anybody that has had some issues in the past with healthcare providers, bad experiences, and I'm coming at them as I'm the clinician, I know best, do as I say kind of thing, that I'm not really going to get very far.
Facts. One of the first things I ask patients is, why did you leave your last dental office? I always want to know, why did you leave your last practice? And you'll hear like some of the craziest things. And I try my best to assure them, you won't find that here. And I apologize you experienced that, but you're in the right place, you know?
Personally, I've been very guilty of that sometimes, of thinking that I know best, especially when I was a newer hygienist, or like, you need to listen to me. You're wrong. You know, I'm right. This is what you have to do. And I had to deconstruct that mindset and reconstruct it to speak about, or to change it to, okay, where are you coming from? What can I do to help you get to here without dismissing you, without dismissing what you believe in, without dismissing the things that make you feel good and happy? You know, how can we work with you and around the things that might be destructive or whatnot, you know? And that kind of goes back to knowing how to listen, knowing how to speak to the population and the people, and just being there.
I had a patient from New Orleans here in Washington, D.C., and he had just recently got some dental benefits, and he was super excited to come in, and he had a mouth, upper interiors, canine and canines, like cemented gold teeth, like inflammation, bone loss, all of these interior teeth, and he did not want to get rid of his gold teeth. This was a norm for him coming from New Orleans. This was his identity. And instead of me saying, you should have these taken out and we can do some beautiful porcelain crowns, I had to ask him, are you okay with me sharing with you what could potentially happen if we do nothing about this? Do you know that this gold in your mouth is attracting biofilm that can help to like destroy your gum tissue and the bone? He's like looking at me like, nobody's ever told me that. They've always told me just to get them out. They never told me why. So I feel like if you meet someone where they are, he's in Washington, D.C., from New Orleans, he's in a completely different culture. And him being from New Orleans is very important to him. But now understanding that this gold in his mouth could potentially cause him to lose his front teeth, he was more open to listening. And now he doesn't have gold teeth anymore. He got them all taken off. But that's really just meeting someone where they are. And instead of making it seem like, you know, I'm a dental hygienist and these golds are ridiculous and awful, you should take them out, I had to really line it up with, who are you as a person and what would you like to see in terms of oral health long term?
I feel like a lot of the conversation we've had today was kind of geared towards us going out in the communities, going out to find people or whatever. But I feel like there's also going to be people that are going to come into our chair, whether we're in private practice, you know, the corporate setup, DSO, whatever. So I was hoping that maybe we could talk about that for just a minute. And if there's anything that we need to apply differently or things that we need to be aware of for our patients that might not seem, I mean, racially, obviously there's going to be, you know, you can right off the bat see certain things that are going to be different from you versus them. But I feel like there's other types of minorities that are out there beyond race that we still need to take into account. So how can we, or what are the things that we need to look at for people that are going to come to, maybe if you're a private practice hygienist listening to this podcast?
I am out of my element here.
Patience. So listening is really important. And when you find a patient who is outside of the normal demographic that you would service, they know that they're a fish out of water and they don't feel comfortable in this private practice setting. So they're kind of looking around like, oh, this is a nice place. I've never been here before. Am I worthy of this care? You know, so you kind of have to just be patient and hear them out, see where they are, and you have to meet them where they are. So my advice to any person who's in private practice and you're not entirely sure how to approach the conversation, listen. You learn so much more by listening. And then you'll find in listening that you and your patient are more alike than you are different. And you have to look for those similarities. And that's going to help you to develop a relationship that's going to be unbreakable.
I would just like to note that you're going to screw it up too. Mm-hmm. you're going to get it wrong. And I hope that when you do get it wrong, that's not something that where you just throw your hands up in the air and you're like, see, I can't even make a difference when I try. Like, it's like, okay, well, what can I learn from that? As somebody who has gotten it wrong many, many times with patients, trying to implement motivational interviewing and just being very ignorant about certain circumstances, just be willing and be open to getting it wrong. Try not to be super messy about it and just be flippant about like applying things. Think about it, but don't get upset and don't get frustrated and feel defeated if you don't get it right the first few times.
Agreed. But a If at first you don't succeed, continue to try. Practice makes perfect. And we call it a practice for a reason, right?
It's easy to feel defeated.
It is. And as hygienists, we're type A. We want to win every single time. So it is easy to feel defeated as a hygienist.
Gosh, you know, we're lucky. The four of us, we know each other from, you know, kind of this kind of interesting part of the profession, right? We're, you know, social media and things like that. But I think that, okay, if you're a listener listening to this show and maybe you don't have the connections that we currently do, the cool thing I think about this community as hygienists is if you read an article, if you like, oh crap, I screwed that up in how I was speaking to that type of patient. Let me find someone who is an expert or who is speaking in this field and really putting in the time and the effort to get better at it. I don't think that, to Michelle's point, is throwing up your hands and saying, well, you know, I screwed up and that's the end of it. Like, that's not the end of it. Like, we need to continue like our educational process, but there are so many people out there that are willing to for free give you the help that you need. And I love that about our hygiene community.
Our guests being two people that would answer questions if any of our listeners would reach out to them. And I think that's a great point, Andrew, that anybody who's ever come on this podcast is a giver in this industry and is really trying to make a difference and there to help guide us when we do, you know, mess it up a little bit or don't do it as like clean and perfect the first time. Like, it's like Alicia said, it's a practice. All of it is.
So as we're kind of winding down, are there any last thoughts that you guys had about this topic that we need to share with our audience?
Again, thank you for having me, everyone. But I would like to think that in addressing disparities that minorities are faced with, the biggest piece is listening, being patient, and understanding that you have a place in prevention. These patients that we're servicing, they need prevention more than anything else. So if you're not taking your time to educate the patient, we're missing the mark. So you have to use your motivational interviewing skills, meet the patient where they are, be patient with the patient, and also let them know that you're an ally. And your whole goal as a dental hygienist is to help them to reduce and prevent inflammation that can cause them to be less healthy overall.
I would say also, don't be afraid to speak up. Like, that job that you have, you probably won't have it forever. There are probably better things out there. Those associates or those colleagues that you thought were good, that you were in, you see their mistakes and sometimes you see their bad intentions. Don't be afraid to speak up to them. Don't be afraid to call them out. Don't be afraid to call out or speak up to your associations, to dentists, to anybody, because at the end of the day, when you do the right thing and you speak up for yourself, your colleagues, the people that you work for, the patients that you serve, eventually, and it might be rough, good things will happen. You know, you will accomplish something. I have been in so much trouble over the years with every one of these levels in every venue. And I can proudly say that, you know, I've come out ahead because honestly, like at some point I just stopped caring about, you know, what they thought and started caring more about what my patients deserve, what my people deserve, what we deserve as hygienists. And you don't screw the haters. Like, in the most PG way I can manage to say it, screw the haters, you know, because eventually, like, it's the loud voices that come through and change will happen. And you will find other people that were too afraid to speak up or say something, come out and support you and empower you. And you're going to be empowering them. And sometimes, you know, you have to be the one that takes that risk or says something uncomfortable or call out your boss or do something to make a difference in, you know, and change lives and change the profession and change the environment.
Awesome.
You guys are amazing for speaking to this topic. It's so timely. It's so needed. I'm really happy to be on this podcast with you guys. Such an honor.
Yeah, it's our pleasure for sure.
No, we're so glad that y'all were able to come on. And I mean, if that's the least we could do is bring awareness, the least. So thank you.
I'm sure people are going to want to reach out, Alicia. How can they contact you, find more about the things that you're doing, maybe listen to you speak or whatever? How can they find you?
I can be found right here in my apartment. You can find me on Facebook. My Facebook name is Alicia Marie, M-A-R-I-E. My Instagram is my first and last name, Alicia Maria, A-L-I-C-I-A-M-U-R-R-I-A. RDH. That's me on Instagram. And if you'd love to follow and support Hygienists for Humanity, you can find us on Instagram as well. That's Hygienists for Humanity.
And Daniel?
I guess all I have is my personal email, which, you know, you feel free to send me questions, ask for articles, just stuff, lopezjdaniel@gmail.com.
Thank you so much, both of you, for being here. This is an absolute pleasure. We didn't even cover most of the stuff that we needed to get to. That's the sad part. We have so much more to talk about.
No, but we had a good conversation. And I think, you know, we did gather some articles that show us really good data on the disparities and reasons for those disparities, and just a lot of good, hard data on what we talked about. So can we make that available somehow? Or
yeah, they'll be in the show notes.
Awesome stuff.
Thank you, everyone.
Well, thank you. Well, another great week, another great episode. We thank you all so much for listening each week. If you haven't already, hit that subscribe button, whatever podcasting app you're using. Also, just a reminder, our guests are so fantastic that they love when you reach out. They love when you interact with them on social media. And you can interact with us on social media as well at Instagram or Facebook. We're also on LinkedIn. You can find us at A Tale of Two Hygienists. You can also go to our website, atale2hygienist.com. And we would love for you to go there and subscribe for our newsletter. We have lots of stuff on our website. We have a learning center. You can search for any episode. This is an easy place for you to find the links for our CE courses and take the test. There's just so much more there. So head over to atale2hygienist.com. And if you want, you can also send us an email. I'm Michelle at atale2hygienist.com. And then there's Andrew, who is Andrew at atale2hygienist.com. And we just want to say thank you so much. If you love this episode and you're loving the podcast, we would love for you to subscribe and leave us a review. And, you know, 5-star, go ahead and do it. 5-star, just hit that 5-star and then leave us a review. We really appreciate it. We love reading them. It fuels our fire. And we just appreciate you guys so much. I think that's it, Andrew. Anything else?
Nope, that's it. Have a good week, everybody.
Bye, y'all.